This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. Good afternoon and welcome once again to Cresta in the Afternoon as we continue. It is now day three of the 2020 countdown, talking about the things that have mattered most, not just right now, not just this week, the things that have mattered most this year. And I think it goes without saying the thing that mattered most to most people this year, other than our faith, of course, is the pandemic. We're seeing it, how it affected all other areas of our lives, our spiritual lives, with the church being closed, certainly affected the election and many other things. And lots of discussion over the last 9 months now about the physical effects of the pandemic, the economic effects of the pandemic, which were certainly a large part of the results we have seen in the election so far. But one thing that unfortunately is not getting enough attention in a lot of people's minds is the mental health effects of the pandemic. And not just the pandemic itself, but the lockdowns that have been a result of this crisis. And so we're going to be talking, Dr. Aaron Cariotti has written extensively on this, done a lot of look at some of the very disturbing data that's been coming out over the last several months. Doctor, you know him well as the author of The Catholic Guide to Depression. He's a professor of psychiatry at the UCI School of Medicine. And he'll be joining us in just a few minutes, looking at some of the things we need to keep keeping in mind as we continue through this challenge. And then later in this hour, a more theological discussion. What atheism can't deliver. This so-called new atheism has become very popular in the recent decades, especially since 9/11. It's this claim that religion is inherently harmful, that we can be good without God, asking whether we are intrinsically religious. Some very deep questions that Dr. Christian Smith tackles in his book, Atheist Overreach, What Atheism Can't Deliver. Dr. Christian Smith is a professor of sociology at the University of Notre Dame, has taught at several other schools. He's joining us for a great discussion. First, we're going to be taking a look at the mental health effects of the pandemic and its associated lockdowns after this news break with Matthew Hanley.
Thanks, Brian, and good afternoon. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Matthew Handley. It's Wednesday, December 23rd, the Feast of St. Thorlak Thorhausen. The news this hour is sponsored by Visiting Angels, providing loving care to seniors in need. More info at visitingangels.com. Pope Francis, at his general audience today, said that Christmas invites us to reflect on the drama of history in which men and women, wounded by sin, ceaselessly search for the truth. Quoting Gaudium et Spes, the Pope said God worked with human hands and a human heart. He said this reality gives us joy and courage because God did not look on us from afar. He did not pass us by. At least 21 people are hospitalized after a partial roof collapse of an office building in downtown Baltimore. The collapse from the 10th floor of the Baltimore Gas and Electric building left two workers dangling from scaffolding. Firefighters were able to rescue them and were still searching the building. A cause of the collapse is under investigation. BGE says it was related to construction. A new study from the Harvard Medical School shows pregnant women are unlikely to pass COVID-19 to their newborns. Researchers studied 127 pregnant women admitted to hospitals during the pandemic. Half tested positive for COVID-19, but all of their newborns were unaffected. Scientists said they found the virus in respiratory fluids, but it did not travel to the placenta or the bloodstream. Nearly one quarter of total registered voters have already cast their ballots in the Georgia Senate runoff election. According to the U.S. Elections Project, almost 1.7 million Georgians have voted either in person or sent in their ballots as of Tuesday. Of the mail-in ballots, just over 621,000 have already been sent, which translates to a return rate of roughly 47%. President-elect Joe Biden is rolling out his pick for Secretary of Education. Miguel Cardona is the Education Commissioner of Connecticut. Biden hosted an event in Delaware and called educators selfless and dedicated. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Matthew Handley. The Cresta in the Afternoon 2020 countdown continues now with number 21.
The best.
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 The Cresta in the Afternoon countdown. Number 21.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Over the last 6 months, there's been a lot of discussion about the physical and economic impact of COVID-19. And there's one issue, though, that has been, it's been there talked about, but it hasn't really gotten a spotlight on it as it should. And that is the question of mental health. Data shows that nearly half of Americans have reported some type of mental health fallout as a result of the pandemic. And with me to talk about this and related matters is Dr. Aaron Cariotti. He's the author of The Catholic Guide to Depression, professor of psychiatry at UCI School of Medicine, director of the medical ethics program there, and he serves as chairman of the medical ethics committee at UCI Hospital and at the California Department of State Hospitals. He's senior fellow and director of the program in health and human flourishing at the Zephyr Institute in Palo Alto, California. Well, Dr. Cariotti, good to have you back. Thanks.
It's great to be here, Al. Thank you for the invitation to talk about this issue.
When did it become clear that we were going to have some sort of mental health crisis as a result of the lockdown that began in March?
So I think a lot of folks were anticipating that there would be problems in this regard. I think the data and the studies that really indicated that those worries were borne out started appearing about a month ago. And I mentioned in an article I wrote recently for Public Discourse, one report that came out actually from the CDC, and given how the media has sort of hung on every word that the CDC has published recently on COVID, I was surprised that this report didn't get more media attention. It was a very good study of population-based, randomly sampled study of over 5,000 Americans looking at the effects of lockdowns on our mental health. And just to mention a couple of findings from that study, if you compare, this was done in June of 2020. If you compare June of 2020 during the lockdowns to June of the previous year, 2019, we saw that the prevalence of anxiety disorders in the general population had tripled, and the prevalence of depressive disorders had quadrupled. We saw rising rates of people reporting that sometime in the last month, not in their entire lifespan, but just in the last month, 1 in 10 Americans had seriously contemplated suicide.
Wow.
And an even more concerning number to me, Al, was among young people, those young adults aged 18 to 25, that number was 25%. In other words, one quarter of young adults in America had contemplated suicide during the month of June.
Wow.
These statistics are, for a psychiatrist, extremely concerning.
Yeah.
It's rare to see these kinds of significant shifts in mental health epidemiology from 1 year to the next. And so one of the things I'm concerned about now is, you know, everyone seems to be an expert on public health and on epidemiology these days, right? But it all seems to be focused on COVID case curves or on COVID mortality numbers, forgetting about the fact that our collective responses to COVID, the stay-at-home orders, the other measures to close schools and to close businesses, even if you're just looking at health outcomes, setting aside economics, you can't actually separate health and economics, but even supposing you could, just looking at the health outcomes alone, there's a lot of things that we ought to be paying attention to that we're ignoring, and one very important piece of that is mental health, because these things cause significant not just impairment and morbidity, but mortality. I mean, completed suicide, death by alcohol-related illnesses, death by drug overdose, these things are liable to do just as much damage as this virus could do if we're not wise and prudent and discerning regarding the decisions that we make collectively.
Yeah. So have they? So, for instance, there was so much conversation over the last 10 years, 15 years regarding opioid abuse. Did opioid deaths, overdoses, grow during the last 6 months?
The answer to that is yes. So far, we've seen a 40% increase in overdose-related deaths in several different jurisdictions.
That's huge.
And more than 40 states have reported increases in overdose-related deaths since the pandemic began. And as you pointed out, Al, this was an issue prior to
right.
the coronavirus
yeah.
pandemic, right? Yeah. So the opioid crisis, so-called deaths of despair, death by suicide, drug overdose, and alcohol-related illnesses were on the rise. They've been rising since 2009. Right, and we saw a slight downtick, maybe starting to turn the corner on some of those issues last year. But then what we've seen since the coronavirus lockdowns is another sharp increase. So we don't have all the final tallies and the final numbers in on that yet. We don't have the completed suicide numbers yet. But all of the early indications that we're receiving suggest that the news is not going to be good in that regard.
And what is the reason for this? Is it high anxiety and fear based on the prevalence of the virus? So, you know, everybody's a little more skittish. Is it that we're not visiting one another? We're not certainly not hugging one another like we used to.
Yeah.
What is the cause for this?
So I think it's both of those. I think people really are afraid of acquiring the virus itself or fearing for what might happen to loved ones who may be at risk of worse outcomes with COVID. But it's also, again, not just the virus, but our collective decisions in response to the virus. Social isolation and loneliness can kill people.
Yeah.
And if that sounds exaggerated, you know, consider one of the worst forms of punishment that we can inflict on a fellow human being is to put a person in solitary confinement,
right,
where they don't
right.
have human interaction with other people. We are social animals, as Aristotle pointed out.
Yep.
We are creatures that are made to be in communion and in connection with other people. So one of the curious recent findings is that we're seeing more people die of Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia since March, in excess of 13,000 deaths. Over and above what we would expect to see from those illnesses.
Yeah.
And we're trying to protect those people from acquiring COVID. Obviously, they're at higher risk of bad outcomes from the virus. But one of the few things that we know can slow the progression of dementia is contact with other people and
mm-hmm.
social stimulation and engaging with loved ones. And without that, people with these illnesses are liable to become depressed, to become much more passive and bedbound. When people sort of give up hope and they don't have a reason to get up in the morning, that's going to have profoundly negative impacts, not just on their mental health, but on their physical health, too.
Yeah.
They're going to be at higher risk for bad physical health outcomes, including early mortality, including dying sooner than they otherwise would have from a progressive disease like Alzheimer's.
In talking with people, I've noticed that there's a lot of ambiguity, people wondering exactly how they should handle this, and they adopt this maxim from this person, or they watch the CDC recommends this. But I noticed something that is common to many people, and that is that they imagine that life's not going to get normal again, quote, normal, until there's a vaccine. So there's kind of a strange living in hope that the vaccine will restore normalcy. Have you seen that?
I have seen that without a doubt, and I see that among our leaders. I think,
yeah.
you know, in the
yeah.
beginning, the rationale for the shutdowns was to flatten the curve, by which we meant let's not get so many cases so quickly that we overwhelm our hospitals. Well, we did that. You know, hospitals in New York came close to being overwhelmed with too many cases, but we never got to the point where we had to ration ventilators, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we flattened the curve, and then the public rhetoric shift occurred where people started the leaders started talking about staying home in order to save lives. Well, staying home doesn't really save lives. It just slows the spread of the virus. The only thing that will save lives is if enough people acquire the virus and develop natural immunity, or if we get a highly effective vaccine. So I think the secret hope is that we can sort of keep things locked down until we get this highly effective vaccine. Now, I'm hoping and praying that that occurs, but there's certainly no guarantees that we're going to have an effective vaccine anytime soon. A lot of folks, Al, don't know this, but the threshold that the CDC and the FDA have set for approving a COVID vaccine is that it needs to be 50% more effective than a placebo at preventing coronavirus illness.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It doesn't have to be 100% effective, not even close to 100% effective. It just has to be 50% more effective than giving a sugar pill.
Interesting.
And so if a vaccine gets approved, there's no guarantee that it will work well enough for us to, quote unquote, go back to normal.
Right? Wow.
So I think what has to happen is we have to stop looking just at the coronavirus itself, and we need to start looking at all of the effects that this current crisis is having on people. And then we're going to have to make some tough decisions. We're going to have to make some public health decisions where we weigh the pros and cons of opening up more versus locking down more. And I guess what I would want to suggest is that if we only look at the coronavirus numbers, that's not going to provide wise guidance, because there's going to be all kinds of collateral damage that we're ignoring.
Right.
And the fact is, we do this all the time, right? We take public health risks in our ordinary lives every day. We know we could save a certain number of lives and prevent people from dying in motor vehicle accidents if we made a law that said people can only drive 5 miles an hour.
Right.
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 Does that mean that we intend the death of all those people because we allow people to drive at much faster speeds? No, it doesn't mean we're embracing the death of all those people. It just means we're weighing certain risks against certain other public goods, like ease of transportation, and we're trying to navigate a sensible course in that regard. Not being reckless on the one hand, but also allowing people to live their lives in a reasonable way that allows for some degree of risk. And this fantasy that seems to be cultivated now is that we can somehow avoid those trade-offs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one death is too many. Makes sense as an expression of sympathy for those who have died,
right.
But it doesn't make sense as an expression of a good public health policy.
Right.
You know, if we took that approach to driving, then we would never get anywhere, literally.
No, very good point. Aaron, thank you so much. Wonderful talking with you again. And we'll talk, I hope, soon. And I hope we get some public clarity on these matters. They certainly need leadership. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Al.
Coming up, we'll talk with Gregory Graham about his meandering journey from atheism to Catholicism.
There is a silent suffering happening all around us. Families don't know where they will get their next meal. Diseases go untreated. Jesus tells us that following him means that when we see someone who is hungry, we feed them. When we see someone who is sick, we care for them. At Hope Clinic, you can be salt and light in the world. Last year, your support met over 60,000 requests for help. Visit thehopeclinic.org to make lives better in Jesus' name.
Since 1916, a lot of independent agents have recommended auto owners insurance, and a lot of parents have taken that recommendation to heart. So have a lot of their children, and grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. As we celebrate our first 100 years, Auto Owners Insurance thanks all those who have put their trust in us, and all the generations who will.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200.
Be a blessing to your neighbors in need through your gift to Catholic Charities of Southeast Michigan. Together we can change the faces of despair, loneliness, hunger, and addiction, one blessing at a time. As the charitable arm for the corporal works of mercy throughout the Archdiocese of Detroit, Catholic Charities exists to provide the services that make a difference in the lives of over 20,000 people each and every year in Southeast Michigan. So how would you like to bless your neighbor today? Visit ccsem.org/donate to choose your involvement.
John Hale here of Corporate Travel, announcing an innovative and affordable way to reclaim your child's educational experience. MyFamilyFieldTrip.com presents educational tours that are better, easier, and more affordable. Traveling at your own convenience from the time of your arrival, we handle all of your travel arrangements and deliver an educational, faith-based itinerary. Book your 2021 tour online today, and you will receive an additional free hotel night on any of our Catholic DC tours. Go to MyFamilyFieldTrip.com and use the code FREENIGHTAMR.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, every Christian church has its own ancient and indigenous chant, which is sung by the faithful during liturgical services. This gives cantors a special place in Eastern Christian liturgy.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
Detroit Catholic and Funeral Home Services and all Archdiocese cemeteries want to wish everyone a very blessed Christmas and a Happy New Year. We realize this time of year can be challenging for many of our families. Please know we are praying for you on a consistent and daily basis to help everyone rely on Christ at this time. If you would like more information about your Archdiocese of Detroit cemeteries, please contact us at cfcsdetroit.org. We await you in joyful hope.
This program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
You don't let an oil company decide which car you drive, and you don't let an airline decide your destination. So why let insurance limit your health care options? We believe there's a better way of doing health care. CMF Curo is the Catholic health care ministry that gives you control over your health care decisions by partnering with one of the nation's most trusted health-sharing organizations. Now is the time to experience affordable, pro-life health care. Find out more at MyCatholicHealthCare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthCare.com.
How beautiful and exciting is it to drive around during this Christmas season and notice the Christmas decorations and lights on homes and businesses? This truly is the most wonderful time of the year, and for that reason, we're celebrating our Big Finish 2020, going on all month. Right now, all new vehicles are eligible for Employee Plus pricing, which in most cases is the $7,000 to $10,000 advantage. Pinckney Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram wishes you and your family a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Experience the difference during our Big Finish 2020. Shop online at PinckneyChrysler.com.
The best.
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 Of Cresta in the Afternoon. Countdown. Number 20.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Since the turn of the millennium, or actually since 9/11 and the rise of the new atheism, which occurs right after that, you've got an atheism which has become more visible, more popular, I would say, and arguably more influential. And there are many apologists for atheism out there. And then you've also got people who are what used to be called, or still are called, practical atheists, those who live as though God didn't exist. There are many questions that come up about atheism. For instance, can an atheist be good without God? Is an atheist denying something that's intrinsic to human nature? Is there somehow, are human beings intrinsically religious? And that would put atheists in the position of denying an aspect of their nature. And also, are atheists compelled to that position by the findings of the natural sciences? My guest, Dr. Christian Smith, is professor of sociology at the University of Notre Dame. He has taught in a variety of places, Notre Dame, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Gordon College in Massachusetts, and is the author of a wide range of books looking at, one of them is called, for instance, What is a Person? Rethinking Humanity, Social Life, and the Moral Good. The Bible Made Impossible, Why Biblicism is Not Truly an Evangelical Reading of Scripture, Religious Parenting, Transmitting Faith and Values in Contemporary America. He's also recently given us, contributed, a book called Atheist Overreach, What Atheism Can't Deliver. Dr. Smith, good to have you with me. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
The book Atheist Overreach, What Atheism Can't Deliver, let's just go with the word overreach. What do you think, what are atheists overreaching at?
Yeah, so the book is not arguing that atheism is wrong. It's just trying to say, look, let's suppose atheism is true. Advocates for it these days, what are they claiming? Well, they're claiming that in an atheist universe, according to my argument, they're claiming that in an atheist universe, human beings have reasons to be much more moral, morally upright and cooperative and believe in human rights and human dignity than I think they have good rational reason to believe. That's the main focus of the book, is on morality. Like, how good are humans entitled or responsible to be if there is no God? And I just think so many, not all, but so many of the atheist advocates today are making claims they can't support. They're just not rationally justified. I think humans have a reason to be modestly, cautiously moral, but not ambitiously moral.
You're not saying, of course, that atheists can't be good people, because they don't believe
in
God.
The key idea here is that whether we have good reasons to be really good people. Of course, a lot of atheists are great people. That's
right.
Fine.
Sure.
It's partly because they've inherited a millennia of religious culture and heritage and sensibilities. But set that aside, of course, people can be good even if they have no good reason to. But part of my argument is that it's really hard over generation to generation, if people don't believe in a God, to pass on and to persuade people to be highly religious, to be committed to human dignity, to human rights, to universal human benevolence, and to explain to children and grandchildren, why should we do that? Why should I sacrifice myself for strangers, for example?
Right, right. Yeah, this question of universal benevolence, it really strikes me. Throughout most of human history, loyalties have been determined by, you know, family, tribe, cult, clan. But most modern atheists talk as though it's natural for us to look at the world and feel as though we have some moral obligation to all others, well beyond our family, our clan, our tribe. What's the basis for them saying that?
Well, you're right. People are pretty good at being good to those in their in-group, but being hostile to those in their out-group. My sociological analysis is that the modern atheists have just taken over a whole bunch of moral sensibilities that have been inherited in the West through Christendom and Judaism.
Right.
And have just eliminated the metaphysical basis for the moral commitments, but want to hold on to the moral commitments. But as I say, morality flows from metaphysics. If you don't have the metaphysics, it's not clear why you should believe in universal benevolence. So if you believe that all humans are made in God's image, or that God himself God has united himself to all of humanity through the incarnation, or some such theological doctrine, then you have to believe every last human being has dignity, deserves to be loved and protected, and so on. Well, if you get rid of the God part of that, then on what basis? It's empirically, it's not clear that all human beings are equal. Empirically, it's very unclear. Why should I care about somebody on the other side of the world that may actually hate me?
Yeah.
I just don't see the basis of it.
Yeah, in fact, you quote Epstein here saying, we humanists are committed to treating each person as having inherent worth and dignity. Everyone must make a decision together, not just as a family, a clan, tribe, city, nation, or block of nations, but as the human species. We must decide, all of us together, to survive, end quote. That presupposes that we share, a common human nature, we have a common set of values, we have a common worth. And is there a basis?
Yeah, and to,
go ahead. Yeah.
To make that argument work, these particular atheist authors really have to downplay the conflict of interest between different human beings and different human groups. And what's ironic to me in all this is I always had the impression that atheists were among the most hard-headed, rationalist, just the facts, let's be really serious and honest with ourselves about the truth of things. But in these arguments, these particular atheists just seem to be engaging in wishful thinking.
Yeah, Yeah. I mean, do they try to work out the problem of competing interests, self-interest versus, you know, universal interest?
Yeah, they generally address it. I mean, you have to address it, but then I don't find any particularly, at least in these authors that I'm engaging, any particularly compelling resolution. Some of them just kind of hand wave it away. Others offer solutions that are just empirically, if you know what human beings are like, just empirically naive. And so I think, especially, let's suppose the future of human society becomes more difficult, challenging, there's more scarcity. It's just not going to hold up.
Right.
It's just not going to hold up.
Yeah. How do you teach your children, right? I mean, that's one of the tests of whether...
Yeah, like you may have inherited, you may believe in Immanuel Kant, or you may believe in, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but one or two generations down, how do you explain to smart grandchildren who say, why should I believe in that? Why should I care about those people?
Yeah.
Especially when it's costly, when it's difficult.
Yeah, yeah. I remember before his death, of course, Christopher Hitchens was on this program, and I asked him this question, which often comes up in this area of ethics, which is utilitarian test. If I asked him, I said, if you had the opportunity to, you know, bring about authentic utopia, but had to do so by tormenting an infant, would you do it? And, you know, he admitted that, no, he wouldn't do it, that he believed it was intrinsically wrong to torment an infant. And even if he could bring about this great good of, universal benevolence and sharing. Is that an unusual position for an atheist?
Well, the atheist authors that I'm analyzing, they're not ideologically committed to one moral perspective, such as utilitarianism. Of course, utilitarianism has no intrinsic doctrine of human rights.
Right.
It's totally consequentialist. So if he said, no, it's intrinsically wrong to torture an infant, he switched out of utilitarianism into some other mode of ethical thinking. So what I find is that there's a sort of an amalgamation of different moral reasonings pieced together. Some is consequentialist, utilitarian, some of which is sort of pragmatic, well, whatever will work for us, some of which is scientistic. It says, well, science will lead us in the direction of how things will really work. So it's hard to pin it down with some of these people and to sort of follow an argument to its rational conclusion. But in the end, I would simply repeat that if your fundamental approach is, look, let's just make as much happiness as we can and have as positive a world as we can, it always raises the question, well, how are you going to do that,
right,
and who will have to be sacrificed?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're really a strong evolutionist, it's, there are versions of eugenics, for example, that I think can't be taken off the table. There are dumb versions that are based on bad science, but there are versions of, like, hey, there's a certain number of people in the world who just obstruct us having a better world. Why don't we get rid of them?
Right, right. You mentioned earlier atheists like to present themselves as kind of hard-headed, but in fact, they frequently cannot rationally justify many of their beliefs. What about this idea, which often comes up with atheists, that somehow the method of the natural sciences is the primary or even only way by which we can determine what's real? Does that kind of, I don't know what it would call, naturalism, materialism, warrant saying God doesn't exist?
Well, I mean, there are two important points to make here. One is that naturalism and materialism are themselves pre-scientific philosophical commitments.
Mm-hmm.
They're metaphysical commitments. And it's not clear at all, on rational grounds, why they deserve to be privileged over, say, theism.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that we can't allow a kind of a viciously circular idea that science shows that only naturalism is true, and therefore we have to be naturalists and rely totally on science. those commitments have no more rational warrant than theism, mm-hmm. in my view. So, and there's a lot of serious problems with being a naturalist or, and especially a materialist. I mean, it just leads to huge problems, which a lot of philosophers are aware of, but a lot of non-philosophers don't necessarily get it.
Right, right.
The second point is, again, if we're hardcore naturalists or materialists, then where does morality come from? Why should we be committed to universal benevolence?
Right, right. Dr. Smith, hold it there. I hear the music coming up. We need to take a quick break. We'll be back. My guest, Dr. Christian Smith, looking at his book, Atheist Overreach, What Atheism Can't Deliver.
The Wine Palace in Livonia is a proud sponsor of Ave Maria Radio. The Wine Palace is a family-owned business for over 60 years where their customers come in for great service and for the largest selection in state and competitive prices. For the holidays, ask for Dearborn brand honey-glazed spiral-sliced hams for just $3.70 per pound. This 9,000-square-foot store includes a humidor, specialty wine room, deli, and whiskey library. And delivery is available. Visit the Wine Palace at I-96 in Middlebelt or at thewinepalace.net.
How does the baby move in your tummy?
How does the baby eat?
Can the baby hear me?
How did the baby get in there?
Wow, a pregnancy can sure generate a lot of questions. But what's important is that a baby is a baby, inside and out of the womb. Not just after birth, but 9 months before. At conception.
That's right. Every baby is a miracle. Hello, my name is Marianne Kuharski. I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America. If you know someone who is pregnant or in need of alternatives or assistance or would like to support the work of Pro-Life Across America, please visit our website at prolifeacrossamerica.org or better yet, simply dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword pro-life. Pro-Life Across America is non-political and totally educational.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Over the last 50 years, we've had some of the greatest popes since the Reformation era. So why are things such a mess in American Catholicism? How do we analyze and confront the attacks we're facing? How do we identify wolves in sheep's clothing? How do we re-evangelize the baptized? Dr. Ralph Martin makes sense of a church in crisis and shows pathways forward. He'll make sense of a disordered world. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and you'll find it in our online bookstore.
This Christmas, give meaningful gifts that will keep on giving. Our Lady of Grace bookstore has a terrific selection of Catholic books and Bibles, inspirational art, gifts, and family DVDs to share during the holidays. Also, be sure to get your copies of the Christmas bestsellers, The Spider Who Saved Christmas by Raymond Arroyo and Rescued by Father John Ricardo. They're located in Ann Arbor at US 23 and M14 in Sign Domino's Farms Office Park at Lobby C. Visit OurLadyOfGraceBookstore.com or Facebook for hours and directions. Do you remember writing your Christmas wish list as a child and wondering what Santa would bring? Well, in many developing countries like Haiti, most children don't make Christmas lists and they don't expect Christmas gifts. Often every penny their parents earn must go to basic needs like food, shelter, and water. Now picture the joy of surprising a child with their first Christmas gift. You can spark that magical moment by sending them a box of joy at boxofjoy.org. A rosary and the story of Jesus is included in every box of joy. Give today at boxofjoy.org. Old St. Mary's Catholic Parish in Greektown wishes a blessed Christmas to all and invites everyone to celebrate the joyous season of the Nativity with them at their historic downtown church. Christmas Eve Mass is at 5:30 p.m. and at midnight, and at 8:30 a.m., 10 a.m. in Latin, and 12 noon on Christmas Day. Be sure to experience the music, the beauty, and the tradition of the blessed season with them. Visit oldstmarysdetroit.com for details. That's oldstmarysdetroit.com.
The best.
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 Best. Best. Best. Of Cresta in the Afternoon Countdown. Number 20.
And good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. Christian Smith, the William R. Kennan Jr. Professor of Sociology at the University of Notre Dame. We're looking at the question of atheism and whether atheism, in fact, overreaches in a number of its statements about the nature of reality, about the nature of morality. We often say in Christian circles, we often say that human beings are made for God. And from that kind of popular statement, we conclude that human nature, that human beings are naturally religious. As a sociologist, how do you approach that question?
Yeah, so there's a lot of debates about, you have to step back and ask, what do you mean by naturally religious?
Right.
I think from a sociological point of view, we have to be empirical primarily. And so empirically, we see human beings throughout all of history and in every culture have been religious in various ways, but still religious. The best human efforts, like in the Soviet Union and in other modern societies, to extinguish religion have failed. And what's failed are those political efforts, those atheist efforts. And when they're, after they failed, can people still continue to be religious? There seems to be something, and modern cognitive science also verifies or suggests this, that there's something about the way human cognition works, the way human perception works, the way the human brain works in its natural environment, that makes it easy for people to believe that there are superhuman powers out there, that mm-hmm. there's more to reality than just the material, empirical world that they face. The human drive for meaning, for justice, for significance, for it all adding up to something more than nothing, makes it in very many ways human beings. The answer is, yeah, human beings are naturally religious. Not on theological grounds, but on empirical observational grounds.
Mm-hmm. And yet, we probably all have the experience, I know that I do, of watching men, and in some cases loved ones, actually go to their death refusing to acknowledge the existence of God or even being willing to pray on their deathbed. That seems to be so counter-evidence. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. The idea that humans are naturally religious doesn't mean every last human will be or every society needs to be in order to be functional. There are pretty secular societies that are quite happy and functional. So it's not that every human being in their heart is truly religious. It's that there's something about the human species, about human condition, that lends itself toward a recurrent return to religiousness. In any individual case of a loved one who refuses to pray on their deathbed, for example, I mean, they have particular autobiographical, emotional, genetic factors at work that determine sort of that, or that shape how they behave and live their lives. Right. But sociologically, we're talking more about the strong tendencies or nature of a particular species, human beings.
Mm-hmm. When I was younger, it was common to say that as science progresses, as society becomes willing to guide the evolution of the human race, that religion is becoming less and less a factor, that it's being pushed to the margins of life. People might privately be religious, but religion is losing its social and public significance, and eventually people themselves will no longer believe. Religion is part of an older consciousness. Are people becoming more secular? Is the old idea of secularization still functioning?
Yeah, so you're talking about the old secularization theory, and
yeah.
It seemed very plausible in Europe and to some extent in the United States up until the mid-20th century. Europe definitely became quite, though not absolutely, secularized, and in higher education circles, there were a lot of forces of secularization in the United States. All that was reversed, however, starting in the late 1970s. Empirically, whatever the theory said, there was a resurgence of religion all around the world, whether it was the Islamic Republic in Iran or Jerry Falwell,
right,
or religious leaders in South Africa against apartheid or liberation theology in Latin America. And so it's taken academic theory some decades to catch up to the fact that the world is actually an incredibly, profoundly religious place. Human beings are not giving up on religion. Now, I think the right answer is it's neither A nor Z. There are forces of secularization that clearly are at work in the world, and there are forces of religious power, resurgence, strength that are at work in the world. So there's a lot of complex of forces for and against the ongoing power and belief in religion. Now, then it's a matter of sociological analysis to understand under what conditions, where, with what historical backgrounds, different religious faiths will be in different parts of the world and times in history. But the answer to your question, the old secularization theory has pretty much been demolished.
Okay.
Very few people really are hardcore believers in that anymore.
Really?
The world just isn't like that.
Yeah. So if it ever comes back, it's going to have to come back with a new set of observations.
Yeah, there are smarter people trying to figure out the truth in secularization theory, and it requires a much more careful, nuanced, specified focus on the causal mechanisms of secularization rather than sort of a general linear evolutionary trend.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is it about the rise of modern atheism that emerges after a lot of people point out that it emerges after 9/11 and in the autobiographies of Hitchens and Dawkins and I think Harris, they all acknowledge that they've decided to become atheist evangelists, so to speak, after the Twin Towers bombing. What is it about modern society that enables them to be as successful in making their arguments to a popular audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a number of social forces very particular to that time in history that helped to explain why they felt such passion about this, the new atheists, and why a certain set of people believed them. I mean, of course, the September 11 was a shock, and it associated religion, especially Islam, with violence. And Americans are generally good, positive toward religion as long as they think it's pro-social. But if it's violent, then they become against it.
Yeah.
I also think that a larger sort of macro-historical fact that helped to make new atheism more plausible is since the end of World War II, the United States' major enemy in the world was communism. And, of course, that was godless, atheistic communism.
Right.
And so even if you weren't a religious person in the United States, your general just geopolitical worldview would have understood the United States was on behalf of freedom, capitalism, and belief in God.
Right, sure.
So that changed in 1991. And the dynamics, it took a few years to shift from the major dynamic being anti-communism to war on terror, right?
Right.
But 1991 was exactly the year when the number of Americans who said they were not religious started to rise. It had been stable at 7% for as long as it had been measured. In 1991, that number started to rise, and we know it's much higher now. So it's not that individuals think about the Cold War or think about the war on terror. It's that these create general contexts in which feelings and sensibilities of people, especially young people who don't remember a former era, can find themselves saying, yeah, I don't think I'm religious.
Yeah.
The other major factor, I'll keep this short, the other major factor is the rise of the Christian right, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson in the 1980s. There were a lot of Americans who were just sort of moderately religious, who when they saw the Christian right getting religion involved in politics, They said, I don't want anything to do with that.
Right.
So they started to relabel. They didn't really change their religion. They just started to relabel themselves as not religious.
Yeah, as in opposition to these explicitly religious public figures who they thought were kind of ugly.
Yes, exactly. So these are the kind of larger sociological forces that help to explain. It's not, which is to say, it's not that Hitchens and Dawkins suddenly had some new scientific or intellectual breakthrough that like convinced everybody. There was nothing new there. It was rather a sociological transformation of the context.
Right, right. Let's talk a little bit about the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, those who are less, no longer say, no longer identify that they are affiliated with a formal religious denomination or religious group. What does that tell us about spirituality? Is that a denial that they have any spiritual concerns?
Well, all right. Of course, first of all, you have to ask, what do we mean by spiritual? And the word spiritual is batted around like a badminton birdie.
Yes, that's true.
It could mean anything to anybody. But in the way that you and I might mean spiritual, I mean, I think human beings can't get away from spiritual concerns. Like, humans are ultimately always have, in some broad sense, spiritual concerns with meaning and identity and being part of something bigger than themselves and so on. So part of what the move has been made in the culture and the discourse over the last few decades is the spiritual but not religious category, which is to say, I'm not religious, meaning I don't want to be associated with any religious institution for anything formal. However, I'm still a subjectively in tune person. I care about human inner life. I may still pray or believe there's some larger energy. So the spiritual but not religious category enables people to say, I'm not some kind of a hardcore atheist, materialist person. I still care about spiritual things, whatever that may mean, and anybody can fill that in however they want. But I just don't want to be part of any institutionalized religion.
Right. The great pop singer of the 70s and 80s, Linda Ronstadt, describes herself as a, quote, spiritual atheist, which I'm sure is intended to draw attention to something she thinks is paradoxical. This idea of not wanting to identify with religious institutions, though, does that make it difficult for those of us who are willing and value our affiliation with a particular doctrinal Christian tradition?
Yeah, of course. It's hard. I mean, if you would like to invite people into something that's more institutionally grounded or that's part of a concrete particular tradition, that makes it difficult because people want to keep it at an arm's distance. I think on the point of the institutional arm's distance, it needs to be put in perspective. It's not the case that Americans have just distanced themselves from religion. American trust in every social institution out there has been declining since, say, Eisenhower.
Yeah, okay.
In fact, Americans are more distrustful of other institutions, such as government and banks, than they are of religion.
Okay.
So it's part of a general trend. It's not that religion per se is being sort of picked out and picked on.
Dr. Smith, thanks for joining us today. Very helpful. And I hope we can talk again in the future.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Christian Smith, Atheist Overreach, What Atheism Can't Deliver. It's an outstanding, outstanding book. It's lucid and short, 130 pages.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
Catholic Charities enabled 500,000 people last year to reach financial self-sufficiency. Consider a donor-advised fund with Catholic Charities. Streamline your charitable giving while supporting the causes you care about. Consider a donor advised fund with Catholic Charities. Learn more about how you can maximize your charitable donations with a simple, flexible, and efficient giving tool. Visit ccusa.gives. That's ccusa.gives.
Detroit Catholic and Funeral Home Services and all Archdiocese cemeteries want to wish everyone a very blessed Christmas and a Happy New Year. We realize this time of year can be challenging for many of our families. Please know we are praying for you on a consistent and daily basis to help everyone rely on Christ at this time. If you would like more information about your Archdiocese of Detroit cemeteries, please contact us at cfcsdetroit.org. We await you in joyful hope.
John Hale here of Corporate Travel announcing an innovative and affordable way to reclaim your child's educational experience. MyFamilyFieldTrip.com presents educational tours that are better, easier, and more affordable. Traveling at your own convenience from the time of your arrival, we handle all of your travel arrangements and deliver an educational, faith-based itinerary. Book your 2021 tour online today and you will receive an additional free hotel night on any of our Catholic DC tours. Go to MyFamilyFieldTrip.com and use the code FREENIGHTAMR.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at
844-319-9999. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of this Wednesday edition, Christmas Eve Eve, as you could call it. As we continue through the 2020 countdown, if you are interested in learning more about Dr. Aaron Cariotti's work, you can find him in the Cresta Guest Archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Also go there, go to the bookstore. You can find Dr. Christian Smith's book, Atheist Overreach, What Atheism Can't Deliver, as well as some of his other works are available for you there as well. As we go into the next hour, we are now in the top 20 of the countdown. Kicking things off in the next hour, it'll be Dr. Anthony Clark, taking a look at the basically two-year anniversary now of the Vatican-China deal, which has been renewed for another 2 years, and he'll be looking at a lot of different aspects of that work and what is happening with the church in China. Also in the next hour, one of the big church news stories of this year was the McCarrick Report, which finally came out after more than a year of waiting. George Weigel taking a look at some very specific angles of that work, including this claim that John Paul II should shoulder a lot of the blame for the lack of pursuit over McCarrick. George is going to be taking a look at what John Paul II knew, what some of these other popes knew, and what it means for us today. Stay tuned for another hour of the Best of Crest in the Afternoon. God bless and see you soon.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.